Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 11th, 2005. This session is Vocation, Our Call to Ecological Citizenship, presented in the Fireside Room by Vonda Diefelt. Disc number DEW-2005-01. Let's listen in.
Ecological citizenship. And the description you have read that has been posted around is based on Martin Luther's understanding of vocation. And then I already give you a definition of that. A calling in our life situation that permeates every aspect of our existence. Every aspect of our existence. What is Christian social responsibility? How does our Christian vocation relate to ecology? A Lutheran theology of creation might help us find answers for these questions. And this is what I would like to do in this hour that we have. And I want to start with a question. The question is, what is vocation? Generally, when people talk about vocation and we do it in a theological, spiritual, religious setting, people will say vocation is a call to serve God. And Luther was, in fact, very strict. He said vocation is something that only the Jewish Christian tradition would have. Nowadays, of course, we have a much broader understanding of interfaith dialogue, and we need to say that faith, and as it is experienced also in other religions, will have similar experiences. Vocation is not something exclusive to the Jewish or Christian tradition, although we have to say that the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scripture passages in which God calls the prophets, for instance, are very good examples of what vocation is all about. Or when Jesus calls the disciples, that these are excellent examples of how God calls people. But it's not exclusive to those people, and it's not exclusive to the Jewish or Christian tradition. As I said, vocation permeates all aspects of one's existence. And what I would like to invite us to do this afternoon is to broaden our understanding of what vocation is, because it's not only related to a religious calling to serve in ministry, for instance, but it is something that has to do with how we minister to one another in our daily lives. And that is why I try to describe it as an aspect that, in fact, permeates the totality of our being and includes one's occupation. I'm always very surprised teaching at a Lutheran college how when I address the issue of vocation, that the students will immediately identify that as their occupation, what it is that they are going to be doing after they finish college. I said, well, you are living your vocation right now. It's not reduced to occupation, although it is very deeply related to what we do in our job place. But that is it really reduces the scope if you would just identify vocation with occupation. Vocation, therefore, is how we live our faith in our daily life. And if you take one idea away from this afternoon, is vocation is how we are called to be faithful people, how we are called to follow Christ, and how we do that in our daily lives. The majority of people think, well, Christianity has to do only with, you know, what we do Sunday morning and as we go to church. Well, I have news for you. It's not only related to Sunday morning. It has to do with how we live faith in our daily life. Vocation is a way of working for the good of others. And here I'm drawing directly from what Martin Luther understands as vocation. Vocation is a call to serve God, and as we serve one another. We serve God. Our relationship to God is through faith, but our relationship to our neighbor is in love and service. And that is the foundation of Luther's theology of vocation. I want to move now to the next point, which is what Luther's understanding of vocation. And as I said, I'm drawing on several authors who have done, you know, years and years of research on this. And I'm really, I already recommended the book Luther on Vocation. if any of you want to go a little bit deeper in terms of research. Luther was very clear in saying that the Christian is called to service in any particular station or duty. And that has to do with the mentality over against Luther was reacting. Meaning to say, what was going on in the 15th and 16th century? The medieval Roman Catholic mentality was that one could only follow one's vocation by going into ministry, by being, if you were a woman, by being a nun, if you were a man, by going into priesthood. And Luther was very adamant. He was very strong in saying that we live our vocation not only when we seclude ourselves from daily life, but precisely in that situation, in that position, in our role, the roles that we have, and that is how we live our faith. Vocation, therefore, in the Lutheran understanding, is not restricted to churchly occupations, and it has, of course, we have to address the notion of vocation also in terms of ministry, of ordained ministry, but from a Lutheran understanding, the whole concept of church really changes dramatically because the church is the priesthood of all believers. As church, everybody is the same. It's not only because you have a vocation for the ordained ministry that you are better than the average churchgoer. The communion of saints is precisely the gathering of those who profess the same faith. And as we do that, we are living out our vocation. So some people would have a call for ordained ministry, but being a member of a congregation is also vocation. That's also one of the ways that we are living out our faith in daily life. I'm quoting from a theologian called Mark Colden, and he said, vocation refers to the whole theater of personal, communal, and historical relationships in which one lives. And I really appreciated this quote very much because we tend to think that vocation is something very personal, something very intimate. It has to do with the spiritual connection that we have with our Creator, with our Maker. That it has to do with how I personally feel about my religion or how I experience that calling. In Luther's understanding, we can only live our vocation when it is played out in the community. So the three dimensions, how it affects us as individuals, it's something personal. Yes, everybody, and in that sense, Luther is very strong in saying that we can only talk about God because we have a personal experience of God. We cannot talk about the God of God's love and mercy and justice if we have not had that experience. But the next step is how we live it out in a community of believers, how it is that we live this, and how we get to experience and share that common understanding of our faith, and how we do that in community. And yet, Colden also presents a third dimension, which is the historical relationships. Not only the personal, not only the community, but all the relationships that are ahead of us, the relationships that in which that we are participants. And here also...
could you give an example of that last, the historical?
The historical relationships? I could give you several examples. One is, for instance, how I understand myself in history. I'm a Brazilian, and I bring, as part of my personal history, I know that there are many misgivings, there are many misconstructions that I, as a Brazilian, need to deal with. For instance, the issues of racism, the issues of poverty in my country. These are things that are that I'm also responsible. A very individualistic approach would say, well, you know, this is my generation, and I'm not responsible for what has happened in previous generations. But as a human being, as part of the family of human beings, I have an interconnection with the past, and I also have responsibility toward our future. Our tendency, I think, especially the 21st century, is, well, we have to think about ourselves. We have to think about our generation. And if you follow, for instance, on your public radio, the whole discussion about Social Security, you will see how that impacts. For instance, the decisions that are made today are the decisions that the generations, the two or three generations in the future will have to deal with. And that is type of historical relationships in which one lives. I think it also has to do with our, for instance, the family ties. Not everything is just present. I inherit lots of traditions, and I need to deal with these traditions, and not everything is good. I need to address these things also in my life. Is that okay? Yeah. It is our calling in our situation in life through which we serve God's creative work by being under the law. And here I am summarizing a big chapter in Wayne Green's book. He says we are called in our situation in life, and it's not, God is not calling somebody else to live our lives. God is calling us to live our lives, and to discern that is in fact fundamental. But then how we do that? We serve God's creative work by being under the law. Well, many people say, wait a minute, aren't we justified by faith through grace? What does it have to do with the law? Well, the whole of Lutheran theology is in fact the ambiguity, how a Christian lives between law and gospel. And that is pretty much human history. We are always bound to these two aspects, law and gospel. And I would like to take a couple of minutes to just go into the two uses of the law according to the Lutheran tradition. Maybe many of you are familiar with these notions. You have talked about this in congregation, but I think it's very interesting to point out, especially as we are going to talk about issues of citizenship, and we need to talk about issues such as the law. So there are two uses of the law in Luther's writing. And here I'm drawing, for instance, on his comments on the Galatians, which is really, I mean, when he talks about we are free from the law, and yet we submit to the law, pretty much Luther establishes that there are two uses of the law. The first use of the law is the political, the civil use of the law. And he says, well, what is the political civil use of the law? These are the laws, the regulations, the constitution. These are the things that we have established as part of the parameters for our human relationships. And they are very important. For instance, here at Holden, there are many rules. They guide the way we live in community. And that's very important. So much so that Christians, according to Luther, are invited to be very active in the process of lawmaking, because as Christians, we are responsible. So Luther says, the law is not only good, it is not only necessary, but it is also given by God. So that is very important, that we create laws that assure that justice will in fact prevail. The second use of the law is the theological use of the law. And here is where Luther, this is why we tend to reduce Luther's theology to say, well, Luther in fact was very harsh. He was condemning the theological use of the law. When the law, for instance, was used, compliance and obedience to the law meant that you would achieve salvation. And that is where Luther became very critical. But if we forget the positive use of the law, we will just be overlooking a very important element of Luther's theology. So, but the second use of the law, the theological use of the law, was also very important in Luther's theology, especially because as far as salvation is concerned, the second use of the law reveals our sin to us and also convicts us, because we know that we can never be the ideal followers of the law. We can never be perfect human beings. And that is why theologically the law is also important, because it is a constant reminder of that. I told you earlier that I have just been living in the U.S. for a year, and I have to say that during the past year, I was an avid student of U.S. media, especially television. And I was trying to understand the U.S. culture because, you know, I had studied in the U.S. in the 80s. It was a whole different, well, not only a different decade, a century, but it was, I mean, honestly, past millennium. So I have been watching a lot of TV, and I was totally fascinated by how much the legal system fascinates U.S. citizens. How many TV programs deal with judges, and even your survival, you know, the reality shows have a judgment at the end, and somebody then gets chosen and gets the big prize. And that understanding of the law is totally a critique. It is a critique by Luther because it says, theologically, we need to recognize that we cannot be justified. We can never be justified by doing good works, by just obeying the law. But we can only be justified through faith, and faith alone. And that is what the good news is all about, is to say, well, God, even though you do not comply, even though you always fall short, even though you are not the perfect law-abiding citizen, God still loves you. But yet, if we were to take this and say, well, God will always love me even if I do not comply, even if I do not obey the law, we would make this grace very cheap. And that is why the law is, again, very important, and the theological importance of the law. And I've learned during the past year how much people, especially in the U.S., are fascinated with how can I break the law and not be caught? And that is what the law you know, programs are all about. And I think it's just skewing what Paul was saying in the Epistle to the Galatians, because that is not what this is all about. I want to have us move now into the ethical consequences of this and talk about good works. And again, people will say, hey, wait a minute, aren't we justified by faith? So what is the need for good works? Well, if we say that Lutherans are not for good works, we will not have understand anything of Luther's theology. He was critiquing the theological misuse of the good works when it came to salvation. But there is an imperative, there is a mandate that Christians do good works because we are justified by faith, and faith will just lead to good works. And that is what Luther's theology is all about when it comes to good works. On earth, the law, its first use, guides, compels, protects, and leads us to good works. It is the basis for a just society and a reminder of our social relationships. When we talk about laws, when we talk about regulations, how many of it needs to be reminded? The theological understanding of ourselves as sinful human beings. If you were went to chapel yesterday evening, if you heard Michael's sermon, it's like, in fact, we are dirt. And Luther would say that over and over again. He would say, I'm just, you know, an empty bag. I'm just a rotten human being. He would say that often because he said, and so much more I can receive God's grace because God is so gracious. God is so merciful. And God is always reaching out. But our tendency as human beings is, I mean, if it would depend on us, we would just, you know, simply want to be, to live, you know, a good life of ease. We would be hedonistic. We would not care for others because that is our fallen nature. And that's why we also need the law to remind us that we do have responsibilities. We have a family, we have work, we have nation, we have all of these responsibilities. But then the law is there to remind us of that. But when you do it from a Christian perspective, and I want to go into this a little bit later, we will have a different attitude toward these. because then we are not under the law because it's imposed, it's a yoke, but rather we take this as an invitation because it is our call in this vocation. A second observation about good works. For our salvation, the law, the second use, I mean the theological use of the law, reveals hubris. Hubris is our attempt to justify ourselves as if human beings could just, you know, pull ourselves, you know, up, you know, pulling our bootstraps or something like that. That's, you know, how, as human beings, we are, in fact, very self-centered. We are full of pride, and we would also tend to rebel and also to justify ourselves through words. One of the other classes during this week is by John DeBraff, and he is addressing something, that's why I'm not going into detail about this, is how much of U.S. culture is a culture of justification through good works. It has to do with how people think by using our time, we need to be always so concerned about doing everything. Even during vacation time, we want to read so many books. We want to learn a different language. And there's always that sense, I'm justified by work. If I'm just at rest, I'm not doing anything good. And that is not what this vocation is all about, is to just enjoy God's grace and being able to do that well. Third observation about good works, faith springs into acts of love. Justification by faith frees us from the law for the law. It frees us to serve. Meaning to say, now we do the things that we must do, not because it's an obligation, but because we are justified, because we are assured that we are full human beings. We are empowered to do good works, not because we have to, but because we want to. So the good works are not a cause for our salvation, but because I'm justified by faith. Now I'm free to do it. I will do it willingly. I will do it out of love. So we are free to serve here and now. Vocation offers content to our acts of love, giving meaning to the demands and needs experienced in life. How many people feel totally overwhelmed by all the relationships, by overwhelmed by work, they feel overwhelmed by everything that they need to do? And I think that's one, for instance, when Heidegger talked about human angst, when Paul Tillich talked about sin being the experience of anxiety, I think the 21st century, our generation is dealing with being overwhelmed by the amount of things that we need to do and that we want to do, and there is so little time. And that leads us with a very strong sense of frustration. And a sense of vocation gives us the meaning that we need. It's like, what makes my relationship meaningful? Am I doing something because it's obligation, or is it meaningful to me? In Brazil, I was working a lot with young mothers, a lot. And I was always surprised with how many of them were totally frustrated with the experience of being a parent because they were very young parents, because they would much rather be doing other things. Many of them were teen parents. Their vocation for it was not there. And I think an understanding of vocation as a call means to say, whatever situation in life, there needs to be a call, and you need to find meaning in whatever it is that you are doing. If you do not find meaning and purpose for your existence in whatever you are doing, then maybe it's necessary to rethink. And that is one of the things, for instance, that I would address with young parents and say, God has given you a child. That child is a gift. That child is not a burden. If that child is a burden to you, and you mistreat that child, you will abuse that child, you'll be violent toward that child, then maybe that is not your vocation. And that will free you, acknowledging that will free you to allow somebody else to take that vocation. And that is why, for instance, we have people who adopt because that is their call, even though they do not want to go through the biological experience of childbearing. So you see, it, in a sense, it frees us because our relationships are not burdens, but they are, in fact, options that we can take. A Christian life is not an escape from life as creatures, creaturely life, but a calling to it. Salvation is not a denial of creation, but it's restoration and fulfillment. Many people think that to be a good Christian is to be a very spiritual human being, that it has to do with devotion, meditation, contemplation, prayer. It involves that. Christian life involves all of these aspects. But when Luther was critiquing in the 16th century the monastic theology, when he said, he was very harsh, saying that medieval Catholicism affirmed that salvation would come first to those who were dedicating their lives exclusively to living in monasteries and completely secluded from everyday reality. Luther was saying that is not what this is all about. In his theology of creation, and here I'm drawing particularly on his comments on the book of Genesis, he says, God has given us creation and has placed us in a garden. We no longer live in the Garden of Eden, but God has given us everything that is around us. And that is our place to be. We do not need to be secluded to experience God because God reaches us wherever we are. And that is very important. So many people say, well, salvation needs to be a concern with eschatological issues. What is the last thing? What happens after life? You know, when Christ will come again. So I need to be prepared for that. But Luther's understanding of the sacraments, for instance, when we participate in Holy Communion, the same experience that we have when we participate in the supper is we have a foretaste of the feast to come. We already experience here and now small appetizers of what the reign of God is going to be all about. In the same way, we experience salvation already in small signs. These are the small seeds that we can experience in our midst. And that is so important because we need to celebrate that and we need to announce that to the world at large. So salvation is not denial of creation. It's not as a Christian, I'll just be concerned with, you know, a word of contemplation or prayer, but it is to live here and now. Therefore, creation is not denied, but is restored and fulfilled. The call to follow Christ does not lead to a religious vocation that is removed from daily life, but it transforms our attitude and understanding of our situation. So, for instance, there are many things that we can choose. For instance, I could choose getting married. I could choose my husband. I could choose how many children I wanted to have. I could not choose what gender. But there are so many things that I could not elect. I could not elect who my parents were. I could not elect on siblings. I could not elect on being born in Brazil, for instance. There are many things that are not under my control. And a lot of anxiety people feel nowadays is like when things are not under control, because we have a sense of we only are to the extent in which we are in control of the situation. But in fact, Luther's theology of creation says you never are in control of anything, because God is in control of everything all the time. We are mere instrument of God in whatever it is that we are doing. And by placing that, it just gives you so much more peace. Because say, well, the things that I do, that I can do, I will do them in the name of God. But the things that I cannot do, I'll just place them in God's hand, because God will know, will find a way of solving whatever situation it is. And that is very difficult. That is so difficult, especially in the U.S., because people here, the control is a very important issue. You go to any store, and the first thing people ask you, how may I help you? Have you noticed that? How may I help you? I keep thinking, you know, lady, I'm here actually helping you to keep your job. But, you know, it's that sense, it's like, yeah, I'm the one. Yeah? And you notice how it permeates a whole mentality, because when we talk about vocation, we also always think how it is that I'm going to be doing something for others, but never how others are helping me. And that is acknowledging ourselves as God's creatures. Say, well, other people need to help me too, because I'm not Almighty God. Okay, more about this later. Vocation refers not only to one's occupation, but also avocation, one's state or situation as family member, citizen, community member, and so forth. Avocation is that situation in which you find yourself. That is where you're going to be a faithful believer. That is where you're going to give witness. Many people think that ministry is only related to being a pastor or a priest. Ministry is the ethics of care. How is it that we care for one another? There's a ministry of parenthood. There is the ministry of being a neighbor. There is the ministry of being a friend. All of these are ways how we live our Christian life. It is a calling in creation, doing works for one's neighbor, working for the common good. And we can only do good works if we do them for others. If we do good works only for us, that will be perceived as being selfish. Therefore, good works always have that communal implication. And they target a common good. Not only my good, not only what is good for me, but what is good for the broader community. It involves relationships, situations, contexts, and the role one plays in them. It's deeply related to one's values. What values do we live by? What is important to us? People are not shocked enough when, as Christians, we think, well, we live our Christian faith and we go to church every Sunday, but Sunday afternoon, what happens? From Sunday afternoon until the next Saturday, that has nothing to do with our beliefs. It does. You cannot just take away your Christian hat and say, well, now I'm a secular human being, and not say that what you believe, the values that you stand for, they have no value throughout the week as well. So it has to do, for instance, with how we make use of our natural resources, how we deal with other human beings, how we waste water, or how we treat the soil, or how concerned we are with issues of the quality of air. We tend to think that as Christians, we only will be concerned with salvation as something that happens with the afterlife, and not with the well-being of the whole of creation as it relates to the here and now. We are God's creation. God creates and sustains us. If you remember Luther's comments, both his small catechism and his large catechism, as he explains the ninth and the tenth commandment, he says, I only exist because God created me. Not only has God created me, but God has made sure that I will survive. So everything that God has created is there to nurture and sustain me. And Luther, in many of his prayers and many of the songs that he wrote, he would say, if you go outside and you see the wonders of creation, there is nothing that I, as one of God's creatures, can do is fall on my knees and say, thank you, God, for everything that you have made, including me. and acknowledging that we are God's creatures is a very important part of Lutheran spirituality. To live a Christian life is to be free, to understand oneself as God's creation, and to act as vulnerable beings in need of God's grace. The issue of freedom has to do with the law. So we do good works, not only because God tells us to, but we do it freely because these are acts of love. We understand ourselves as God's creation, meaning to say, I do not live independent of other people's. I exist because other people were there before me, and hopefully there will be other people following me. And that sense of being interconnected, of being interdependent, is very important because we are all part of God's creation. So how we deal with one another as God's creatures is fundamental. How can I pass a person who is begging for food if that person is also part of God's good creation? It changes completely the way that we relate to one another as human beings. I cannot look other people in the eyes and say, well, you are just, I'm totally indifferent to you, to your history, to your suffering, to the joys that you are experiencing, because we are all part of God's creation, and in that sense, we are connected. And the third aspect is vulnerability, and as I said, this is an important element in Lutheran theology that needs to be reclaimed, especially, if you allow me to be so bold and say that, it needs to be reclaimed in the U.S. The U.S. nowadays is suffering from justification by works. Not in the sense of the good works, in the theological sense that Luther critiqued, but in the sense of saying we can build up our own security by our own means. Acknowledging ourselves as God's creatures means to recognize that we are totally vulnerable human beings. As human beings, we are the most fragile creatures on the planet. And yet we built these fortresses in order to masquerade our vulnerability. If we acknowledge that we are vulnerable human beings, we very quickly recognize that our survival, our security can only happen if we can build networks of other among human beings and say, well, we need one another, and not I can live without you, or I only my self-interests are the important ones. And a theology of vulnerability is very much in need in this country. You forgive me for being so bold, but as a Brazilian, I that is one of the things that I feel, that people are just not acknowledging how vulnerable we are, and falling into the traps of false security. And I say that justification by words, and say as if it was possible to live as a human race just by eliminating others, or just by secluding ourselves and not being in dialogue anymore, and just giving up on dialogue and saying violence is the only alternative means. To live faithfully is to recognize that we are simul justus et peccator, or simul justa et peccatrix, if you're a female. Mean to say, at the same time, justified and sinner. And that is what being human beings are about. We are full of ambiguities, we are full of contradictions. I will never claim to be totally saint, and yet I know that by God's grace, I'm worth something because of God's grace, not because of me. And I think that's really the beautiful aspect. We are all, as human beings, we are God's projects, ongoing projects, and we are living in a state of already and not yet, because we experience already what it is to be justified. We can experience that, and we also experience the frustration of not yet, that we are not totally perfect human beings, that we are in a process, and we are God's creation, God using God's creativity through us, in us. And here God is at work in us and through us. the same way as we experience justification, the same way as we experience God's love, we share it with other human beings. So we are God's hands in the work in the world. That's who we are as human beings. Let me move now into the issue of ecology, which is the second point of this presentation: vocation as a call to ecological citizenship. So, ecology—the word ecology—and just a side comment. I'm not going to go into much detail about this because there are other sessions dealing with ecology throughout the week. So, if you have questions or comments, we can go into more detail about that a little bit later. So ecology comes from two Greek words, oikos, which means house, and it's the same root of ecumenism, oikoumene, or economy, oikonomia, and so house, and logos, which is the study. But I want to say that ecology does not relate only to nature or the material realm, because I think that's oversimplifying it. And I wanted to have a broader understanding of ecology as well. Because, after all, I'm a theologian. And from a theological perspective, ecology is the embodiment of God's creation. It defines ourselves. It defines our bodies. It defines our relationships as God-given gifts. So if we say that God, that everything that surrounds us is God's creation, then we need to acknowledge that ecology is not just the study of something. We are not scientists analyzing rocks or fossils or trees or animals. We are talking about ourselves. And that changes the way we talk about ecology, because we are not talking about the subject that is outside us. We're talking about us as part of the whole of creation. And it affirms us as interconnected beings in the totality of God's work of grace. So the whole creation is a manifestation of God's grace. And I think this is really wonderful, because if we can perceive it in that way, we need to be much more respectful, not only of trees and water and soil and air, but much more respectful of other human beings as well. This changes dramatically the way we relate to other human beings. And ecology, before, is the way we live in God's household, because everything, all the space we occupy, is God's household. And how we understand our bodies. For instance, why is it that we mistreat our bodies? More about this later on in the week. Our body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. So our bodies need to be cherished. They need to be well taken care of. How we understand our community. Not only our church is the body of Christ, but how the place I live is the body of Christ. And the whole planet. The whole planet as God's body of creation. You see, this leads to a very different spirituality. Vocation and agency. Vocation requires agency. One does what is good. And here's a quote from Luther. In every calling that serves the good of the neighbor, one can serve God if one fulfills one's duties faithfully. So Luther repeats this. Whenever he talks about vocation, he will always talk about God's call and serve God by serving the good of the neighbor. Vocation is God's gift, shared with other creatures. Therefore, vocation is not self-justification. Many people understand that if they sacrifice themselves, they will inherit the reign of God. And I've seen many parents who do that. It's like, I will sacrifice myself for my daughter or son. And then, you know, it's like that self-justification will assure that, if nothing else, that child will then be so indebted to me that, you know, he or she will be bound to take care of me in my old age. That's usually not how it happens. children take care of their parents if they love them, and not because of obligation. Just a reminder, the gospel without the law is cheap grace. The law without the gospel is bondage. This is, again, Luther on Galatians. We act out of love. And here I just wanted to refer to the great commandment. Above all, we love God. And then we love our neighbor as we love ourselves. The third aspect, I want to talk about ecological citizenship. Commonly understood, a citizen is a native-born or a naturalized person who owes allegiance to a particular country and is entitled to its protection. I'm not a U.S. citizen, and I know what benefits and what I can have and those which I cannot have by not being a U.S. citizen. And that's why the issue of citizenship becomes then a very dear subject, because we tend to reduce citizenship to rights and always individual rights. So if you are in this country, if you are a citizen, you have such rights. And I want to go a little bit further, because citizenship can be both the relationships between a state and an individual citizen, but it can also be the political relationships between the citizens themselves. And that is the aspect that I would like to draw a little bit more. How is it that we establish relationship between ourselves, and not only as citizens, but also as human beings? Citizenship might just refer to rights, but it can also refer to duties, actions, virtues, and opinions of citizens. That's why I said earlier that citizenship requires agency. It has to do with our social responsibility. For instance, when Luther was talking about when he was dealing with the political authorities of his time, he said that all good Christians should be very aware of what the political leaders were doing. So if we understand Christians to be apolitical, we have not understood anything of what Christian life is all about. Because being a good Christian means that I not only am responsible for monitoring what my government is doing, but if my government is not doing what is good for my neighbor, I have not only the right, but the obligation to step in and say, this is not fair. This is not God's will being done. This is not practicing justice. Because it's not only the concern, what is it that the state can do for me? It's not only my well-being. It's not my own good that's being searched. But say, what is it that affects my neighbor negatively? And this is also true for the church, because we are all citizens of the church. In baptism, we become members of the church. So we also have not only the right, but the obligation of monitoring what decisions are being made in the church. Is the church only preaching the maintenance of what has always been, or is the church taking care of the people who are being discriminated, who are being oppressed? Is the church being, in fact, the body of Christ and being inclusive enough and affirming the dignity of those whose dignity is being denied? So it's not only right, it's an obligation. And finally, I want to talk slightly, a little bit about ecological citizenship. In our calling, we serve God's creative work. And here I say, we are, as God's creatures, we partake of God's creativity. Human beings are gifted. We are talented. And God shares God's creativity with us. And that is why we cannot just simply repeat what we have heard in the past. Every new generation needs to find new ways of expressing God's love and the good news of the gospel for our times, because there are always new demands. This is how we give witness of God's love. And one of the things that frightens me the most is how the church nowadays has become a place of exclusion, in which we just, you know, we find ourselves in some type of moral higher ground in which we now can point fingers to other people and say, well, you are not as good as we are. Hey, remember, simul justus et peccator. At the same time, saint and sinner, nobody is better than anybody else. And you are the greatest sinner if you are the one pointing the finger to others. So how do we give witness of God's love? And finally, how do we live according to Jesus' teachings? That is what, for Luther, was the scope of it. What is the good news for us today? What can we say? What are the words that are needed? And how is the Holy Spirit acting in such a way that we can experience God's love through Jesus' teachings today? If we just repeat what the Bible says, if we just repeat what our church history has said, we are just saying yesterday's good news. And that is called tradition. The good news has to come fresh and renewed for us today. It requires from us bold actions. And as Christians, we are not only invited, we are compelled to do that. A Christian understanding of citizenship is broader than one's individual rights. A Christian is not only concerned for me, it includes one's well-being, always, agency, empowerment, but it is also advocacy, assuring the rights of others, not only my rights, but the rights of others. That is what the Christian does. And finally, ecological citizenship includes civic responsibility, meaning to say, what I was saying earlier, to monitor what is going on. A Christian is not an absent-minded person who is only concerned with the spiritual realm. That's very important. But that spirituality nurtures us to be very active citizens, to monitor what our government is doing, how the funds that we how our taxes being employed, and keeping check of these things. That is our responsibility. Accountability. How we are accountable not only to one another, to the whole of creation, but how are we accountable to God for giving us so many gifts and giving us so many talents? You know, one day we'll have to respond to God and say, you know, you were really gifted and talented and you never made use of any of that. Burying treasures. And finally, commitment toward the well-being of the whole creation. Not only our personal well-being, but also the whole creation. I told you earlier that I'm an avid student of American television, and one of the programs that my family enjoys watching is on TLC called Clean Sweep. Have you ever watched that? That is a summary of what God's creation, gone wrong. When it takes a team of people moving into one's house to remove boxes and boxes and boxes of junk, and people just piling up more and more and more, so like that need to have in what one family is getting rid of, 15 families elsewhere would live from, and how we are justified by work, and how we are justified by our possessions. The need to possess, the need to hold on, the need to control. And God just says, no, let it go. Just be committed toward the well-being of the whole creation. Just use what you need and not what makes you look good. And just live a Christian life that fosters the well-being of others, not just, one's greed and just maintaining that. We have a couple of minutes still. We started a little bit late. If you want, I welcome questions and comments and your reaction to all of this. Let me just say it's really a pleasure being with you this afternoon.
Fundamentalism bothers me. I'm reading a book that talks about Mormon fundamentalism by Krakow. And it seems like there the people become so messed up. They don't respect others. Fundamentalism leads to hatred towards others who don't follow their way. And I guess I was wondering, you know, when you talk about faithful people, sometimes they isolate themselves by being so religious. Any comment on that?
Yeah. A Brazilian writer called Fernando Veríssimo, he said, have you ever noticed that people who are religious fundamentalists, they always want to tell you about their truth, and they never want to listen to yours? And that, I mean, he is not a theologian, but I thought to myself, well, isn't that true? To the arrogant presumption that you hold the truth and that you can just point the finger and say, well, you're wrong and I'm right, just creates such an imbalance in which dialogue, conversation is no longer possible. And when people place themselves in such higher ground, as I was saying earlier, you set yourself up for, I think, what is happening, you know, in this country in international relations, as it is happening with economic relations with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. You know, you just dictate, you just tell others, and people. It depends a lot on the power relation. People will listen. People will pretend that they agree if they need you, if you are in such a powerful position. But as soon as you're weak, they will come back and treat you the same way. And that is very scary. What happens, for instance, in terms of religion, religious fundamentalism, when groups who have been historically oppressed and just turn around and do really terrible things. As Christians, we have learned from many, many mistakes. Christianity, in that sense, I mean, you can talk about the Mormons, but the first thing that really opens up for conversation is to acknowledge the simul justus and peccator, and say, well, at the same time, sinner and saint, and say, as a Christian, I will not be the first one pointing fingers because I acknowledge that my own tradition also has many wrongdoings. My Christian tradition, I'm a Christian by conviction, not because only I've been baptized as a Christian. I have become re-enchanted with the teachings of Christianity because I've studied it, but not because it was imposed on me. Because if I just had known from all the wrongdoings, from all the killings and for all the torture that was imposed in the name of Christ. And there are many people who actually leave Christianity because our history is a very bloody history as well. And acknowledging that and saying, you know, doing it very humbly and engaging in conversation in that way and showing that I'm very vulnerable. My history is a very vulnerable history. I am in no position of judging anybody else because as a Christian, I'm responsible for many sins as well. The whole issue of the historical relationships that was pointed out earlier. And I think that invites conversation much more than just saying, well, you're totally wrong. The second aspect is trying to understand what leads people to such stances. I was always extremely critical of Pentecostals and Neo-Pentecostals in Brazil because I think the way they go about doing things, a theology of prosperity, for instance, the way they just manipulate folks and how they play with people's feelings and psychological needs. And yet, trying to understand what leads people to look for that movement in the first place. What do they have that feeds people spiritually? It's something that we do not have. Learn from that and use that information in a way that can actually be constructive. And then I think there needs to be a mutual critique and admonestation. And Luther was very strong. As Christians, we have a responsibility to also critique one another. And we do that in love. Just because I'm a Christian doesn't mean that I'm a nice person all the time. You know, nice here, nice there. You know what nice stands for? You know what nice stands for? N-I-C-E. Nice means nobody is challenged enough. So if somebody says, oh, you are so nice, oh, you didn't challenge me into growth. Of course, you know, you just maintained me in the same position I was before. My encounter with you has not challenged me or changed me a bit, which means, you know, I've been flat. So say, oh, it was so nice. Yeah. Okay. Don't say it was nice. Other comments, questions?
Just really quickly, you were talking about problems with sort of racial oppression in your country, mm-hmm. and as you know from living here, there's huge history and current problem with racial oppression in the U.S. as well, and I think especially in our churches, especially in Protestant churches. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about that, about how race sort of is involved in this issue. Our inability to be connected to others, or inability to be.
Yeah. It has to do with our tendency of naming others according to ourselves and saying, exactly, well, I'm the norm for humanity. Mm-hmm. And look at me, white, Latin American, Protestant, female. Heterosexual, apparent, and say, well, this is not the norm. This is the best. This is as good as it gets. And now everything who is the other, and here I'm using the categories developed both by Enrique Dussel, the historian from Mexico, and by Levinas, say, who is the other? The other is somebody whom I encounter and who challenges me, that face-to-face, that allows me to see that difference is not bad, but is something good. And it takes a theology, it takes a spirituality to see that difference, plurality, the whole rainbow of colors is something positive and is not something negative. And if you analyze the history of Christianity, you see that was very much part of what the Christian movement was all about in its beginning, and how it just broke away and it became very patriarchal, it became very Eurocentric, it became everything who did not comply with that understanding, monolithic understanding, was dismissed as non-valuable. And I think it really took us, you know, it took us to get to the 20th century in order to acknowledge that diversity is something good. Not the type of saying, well, anything goes, but diversity as an expression of God's creation. And saying God's creativity is manifested in me, but is not reduced to me. I'm not the only one of God's creatures. It's like, you are as special as everybody else. and to acknowledge that for Christians, I think, is very important. Yeah, and in Brazil in particular, the Brazilian history is very similar to the history of the U.S., with slavery, with colonialism as, you know, the foundation of the nation as it is. So, yeah, we have had 500 years of that, and still it goes on.
Is it okay for the church to practice clean sweeping?
What do you want to get rid of? I mean, explain. I mean, can you just expand a little bit more?
Well, I was just thinking that there's so many things that clutter our spiritual lives and our and yet we're all so nice in our church. We're all here, you know. There's 20 some of us, and we never really go in and say, get rid of this. Get, you know, change the things that are going on in your life.
And sometimes when you do, something as simple as, you know, this pancake breakfast is really getting old, we need to try something else. It's the end of the world. Literally.
I cook pancakes for 20 years at my church. Yeah. That's what I do.
To reduce the Christian message to a ritual is to impoverish our faith. We need these. It's like symbols. We need them, okay? But this symbol does not contain the totality of God's message. And the problem is when people say, well, if we no longer have this pancake breakfast, then our church will no longer exist. See, when we get our values totally mixed up. What I was saying is, in terms of our values, I'm not talking about the rituals. We need the rituals. And human beings, we need continuity. We need renewal. We want renewal, but we also need continuity. It's always part of that ambiguity that already and not yet that I was talking about. What I find interesting is to say how much of what we learn about Christianity has, in fact, nothing to do with Christianity. We have created a whole set of very legalistic, moralistic type of behaviors and said, well, if you act in this way, then you are not a Christian. If you act in that way, that's being a good Christian. And Jesus, in that sense, he kept breaking boundaries all the time. He was always surprising. His disciples had the hardest time understanding. I mean, they were his disciples, and they could not understand. It's like, he was always surprising them. It's like, whoa, he's talking to a woman, a Samaritan woman. Oh my gosh, here he goes again, talking to a prostitute. It's like, oh my goodness, lepers, lepers. See, these people suffered a lot, and I mean, that's why we are supposed to be disciples, because I think we are supposed to be surprised by God's work constantly, and let ourselves be challenged as well as the disciples were. But maybe more than being disciples, we could also be Jesus' friends and say, yes, I know that I'm not worthy, and yet you accept me as I am, and just being able to rest with that idea, with that notion, and saying, well, no, you are in God's hands, and whatever you do, do it in God's name, and be good Christians, and love one another. It's as simple as that. You know, go back to the big commandments, like, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Do good to other people, and do it in the name of God. Proclaim the good news. That's being good. So, thank you. Our time is totally up. So, thank you. Thank you.